Hey folks, welcome back to another Q&A episode of Mental Health, a new segment on the podcast where we answer your questions, whether they're follow-up questions from previous episodes or random mental health related topics we haven't covered yet. If you'd like to submit your own question and support our ad-free independent show, you can do so by heading to patreon.com/mentalhealthpodcast. And other than that, thanks so much for being here, and we'd really hope that you enjoy.
Hi, Steve and Hugh. My question for you refers to the excellent interview with Dr. Anna Lemke. She was explaining the pleasure and pain seesaw effect in the brain, and when we have pleasure or pain, the brain can overbalance itself, so we can actually feel the opposite emotion. I wanted to know if this is why people self-harm. Thanks for your help, and keep up the good work.
Okay, yeah, thank you for that. That's an I love that question.
What a finely spoken gentleman.
He
should be a podcaster. Articulate. That was so well spoken, Flip.
Well, the beauty of that is he's so eloquent. And of course, I come out of the gate stumbling and fumbling. Dear listener, you have raised the bar so high for us.
I feel like I need to wear a suit for this question. Oh my goodness.
In my mind's eye, because I cannot see you right now, in my mind's eye, we are both fully resplendent. I've got my full academic regalia, you know.
Oh, the robes.
The gown, the robes.
I had a feeling, yeah.
With a little, the funny little beanie cap.
I wasn't sure if like the swish against the microphone was your long beard or it was the tassel, but I guess now I know.
Now, yeah, we're just demystifying the whole, you know, we've already, by the way, dear listener, we've talked about the fact that probably starting this summer, if you want to mark your calendar, we are going to be adding a video feed. We're going to be actually having YouTube video of these episodes, of really every episode, so you won't even have to imagine what this whole operation looks like. Now this may or may not be helpful for some of you. You may be like, I'm good. I think I'll stick with the audio only.
You guys look better somehow, in my mind's eye. This is uncomfortable.
Exactly. Yeah, they're.
He looks like 30 times. Years younger than I imagined him to.
and Steve looks, he looks like an old professor, and that's fine. But like nobody needs to. Well, anyway.
Well, my pledge to you listening is that one live Q&A episode, we will wear a suit. Well, I will wear a suit, and Steve will wear his robes. There you go. It's gonna.
Oh, it's going to be, as the young people used to say, they probably don't even say this anymore. It's going to be lit. It's going to, does anybody say lit anymore?
Those young people have grandkids now. No, I'm only joking.
Every generation, I try to learn their local patois and lingo, you know, so like I'm adding words to my vocabulary, like turnt, you know, that word turnt. And twerking and, but it's like, no, nobody says those things anymore.
What an opener to an episode about self-harm. Welcome to the Mental Health Podcast, guys.
So let's get back to this. This is a really important question. What is going on with somebody who, and, you know, and by somebody, I mean, there are millions of people out there who paradoxically will inflict tissue damage. They will cut themselves. They will burn themselves. They will engage in any number of self-harm behaviors. I've worked with patients who would sometimes bang their head to the point of altered consciousness. I mean, some really self-destructive behavior. And yet what they will report is that actually feels good. That is actually helpful. And I'll tell you, for many decades, self-harm behavior was very confusing for clinicians and patients alike. Back when I was in grad school 30 years ago, the technical term for it was often parasuicidality.
Oh, wow.
Para meaning, para, because it looks, I mean, you know, if you think about it, one of the most common self-harm behaviors is cutting. And well, that, you know, there are suicide attempts that also involve self-cutting.
Dude, that's so telling. It's so interesting. Like, and this shows the generational gap between you and me probably as well. is that I never once would have even put it on the same spectrum of suicidality. But whenever you kind of like lay it out, like, because for me, it's like, oh yeah, that's just self-harm. That's just like something people do. But when you kind of like look at it objectively, you're like, whoa, yeah, you're right.
Yeah. And so for, if we go back 30 years ago, many clinicians, when they saw their patients who were cutting on their wrists, they're like, oh, is, you know, that looks like a suicide attempt. And then the insight was, well, yeah, it looks like it, but there's really no suicidal intent there. So then the term parasuicide, which is a fancy way of saying, yeah, it's, it looks like that, but it's not. So you think of like paranormal or parapsychology or, you know, anything with para as a prefix, it means it kind of, it's in the ballpark, but it's not really the thing. It only appears to be. Okay. So for decades, it was a mystery. Why would people cut themselves or burn themselves or hurt themselves? And what are they getting out of it? Mm. Now, the really interesting thing is when you would ask patients what they're getting out of it, they often couldn't tell you, other than to say, I don't understand it, but I just know that I feel better. It feels like a sense of relief. By the way, we also get this with patients, many patients who induce vomiting after a binge eating episode. So vomiting, it turns out, can also fit this paradigm of something that seems to be really unpleasant. And yet what patients report is this huge wave of relief and a sense of release. So what did we discover? Well, whenever the body is physically challenged, whenever we experience physical pain or the discomfort of vomiting, we get this massive release of the brain's own, what we call endogenous or self-built opiates and cannabinoids. So we have these natural opiates in the brain called endorphins, and we have these natural, basically cannabis chemicals, molecules called endocannabinoids. And they hit targets in very primitive circuits in the center of the brain that are involved both in a feeling of reward and, more importantly, probably for our purposes here, in a sensation of pain relief. So think about, you know, what is job one of many opiate medications? It's to relieve pain. And as we've talked about before, the brain circuits that model physical pain, that give us that experience of physical pain, are intimately interwoven with the circuits that generate emotional pain. And so the bizarre discovery is that when somebody self-harms, yes, they get a little burst of actual physical pain, but that then gives way to this massive release of endorphins and endocannabinoids, and they hit the brain's pain centers that give pain relief, massive pain relief, not just of the initial physical pain, but also of whatever emotional pain preceded the self-harm. So if you ask people who self-harm, what are the contexts, what are the situations in which you're likely to do this? It very, very commonly, it's like, well, I do it when I'm upset. I do it when I'm feeling tense or stressed or incredibly overwhelmed or sad. And I can't explain it, but I just know that it makes me feel better. And from a neuroscience perspective, it's like, oh, we have actually demystified this. We've broken the code. You are, by self-harming, you are coaxing your brain into releasing its own painkillers. And so we can validate it. We can have compassion. We can understand it. Obviously, and I want to make this very clear to anyone listening who thinks, oh, that's a, you know, that sounds like a good idea. It's not a good idea. Many patients who get caught in a kind of addictive pattern of self-harm for pain relief end up actually doing some pretty serious damage, you know, like severing tendons or inflicting third degree burns or giving themselves a concussion. So
yeah, because it is like the Anna Lemke seesaw in effect, I guess, you know, where it's like any drug of choice, and I use that term quite broadly, or any addiction.
Yeah.
You know, the first time you do it, you get a big hit, and then you have to go even further or take more the next time to get that same hit. And then that's wham bam how you get caught in the vortex or the spiral, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. So they're just like we develop tolerance. So if somebody, you know, becomes an opiate addict, the first month or two, of their addiction, they're getting this massive effect from the oxycodone or the Vicodin or the heroin or, you know, whatever, the Percocet. But over time, the brain begins adapting. They develop tolerance effects. It's same thing, really, with that natural endorphin release. Although, interestingly enough, if you talk to a lot of athletes who get a runner's high, so somebody who's an endurance athlete, and after, say, 45 minutes or so of very intense activity, there is a kind of pain that's involved with endurance athletic activities. But if the runner's high kicks in, then there's something incredibly rewarding about it. And even the physical pain begins to recede. And long-term athletes will tell you, yeah, I've been running for 20, 30 years and I still get it. It may not be as intense as it was initially, but there's never complete habituation to that, that sensation.
Dude, chasing the dragon. Something you said, yeah. I'm going off the deep end here, of like more bad ideas that you shouldn't try at home. But whenever you kind of said that there are, I'm going to butcher this, but like pathways or circuits in your brain that will, like, if you do a physical thing, provide relief to your emotional pain. Can you debunk something for me? So there was a, how do I phrase this anonymously? There were a few people that went to my school, there you go, that's vague enough, who got really hooked on like painkillers. So just like something like ibuprofen and paracetamol. I don't know what the American translation of that is. Acetaminophen.
Advil and Tylenol. And,
Advil
and Tylenol. Yeah.
But they claimed, they swore that it also worked for like emotional pain as well. Is there any sort of like what you just said, does that apply in this context as well?
It does. Yeah, absolutely.
Dude, that's
so there's
freaky.
Been some really, there have been some really elegant studies showing. There's one, and I believe it's been replicated a few times, where they experimentally expose people to a situation of social discomfort, where you sign up for an experiment and maybe you get paid a little amount of money, and you're going to have to give a little totally extemporaneous, ad hoc, impromptu speech for 5 minutes. They give you a topic like, okay, Hugh, ready, set, go. You're going to go in front of this panel of four judges and give a 5 minute talk on the value of free trade, just some random topic that you probably haven't thought about a whole lot.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you very much for coming here today. The topic of free trade is something that's really, really close to my heart.
Thank you for coming to my TED talk on free trade. Yeah. Well, so, but then the kicker is the judges, the person believes that they're just fellow students or, whatever, fellow experimental participants, but they are, in fact, they're ringers, they're plants, they're part of the experimental team, and they have been coached to be very annoying and stern and scowling and grunting and, basically just making it extremely unpleasant. And, somehow they also contrive you're going to get, but you're going to consume this beverage ahead of time, and it could be, flavored water. It could be vodka. It could be, something with a pain reliever in it. And, the people that got the pain reliever were, reported considerably less emotional pain of social rejection, of being judged. And we have a lot of converging lines of evidence that physical pain relief also provides emotional pain relief. Not completely, but enough so that we notice it. And, you know, it turns out that a lot of opiate addicts, just like a lot of alcoholics, are driven in large part from a kind of emotional pain relief that they get as their pain circuits are, I mean, you know, if you think back 200 years ago before the advent of effective anesthetic agents for surgery, people very often would be induced to get their blood alcohol concentration up way up into the anesthetic range, where they basically, if you, now it's very dangerous because a person can stop breathing, but you know, prior to even things like ether, which is a very primitive early anesthetic, if you got somebody drunk enough, they would actually be in a state of surgical anesthesia. Damn. And like, okay, you can take their appendix out. And so just to give you a sense of like, yes, alcohol is a pain reliever at a certain dose. And many people who become addicted are addicted not just because it lights up the brain's reward pathways, but because they get that pain relief. They're hurting and they're numbing the pain. And self-harm behavior has a very similar dynamic. So in all these cases, we don't just want to take away that self-medicating strategy. We want to replace it with something that is far more adaptive and far less harmful. And, you know, that's why it's so critical that if somebody is self-harming, we're not just going to judge them and shame them and say, oh, well, you know, this is horrible. Why are you cutting yourself? Why are you burning yourself? Why are you, you know, doing these horrible things? We have to look at it with compassion and say, oh, they're hurting. This is a strategy that they've stumbled upon. It's a destructive strategy ultimately. So let's help them find some much more adaptive ways of dealing with that pain.
Yeah. And I think like when we talk about any behavior that is sticky in our lives, whether we would categorize it as an addiction or not, I think it's always so important that we really honestly look and see like, how is this serving us? You know, because it must serve some sort of a purpose for it to remain in our lives, you know. And as Steve said, it's once you figure that out, once you figure out the why, then I guess you can go shopping around for healthy replacements.
Absolutely. Yeah. And by the way, there can, just like we've talked about this, I think, a little bit when we in Addiction 101, where we're like, yeah, okay, last year in the US, over 100,000 people died of accidental drug overdose, and most of it was opiates, fentanyl, and all the prescription versions that we talked about a minute ago. And so there's an intermediate step where you can take somebody who's an opiate addict, where there's a very high likelihood that they're going to accidentally OD and die on these drugs. You can cross them over to something that's probably not going to kill them, but it's still an opiate, right? So you can put them on methadone. You can put them on buprenorphine, where like they can still function. They're not going to probably have a lethal overdose. It's not great because they still have this addiction, but at least it's a harm reduction model. And so let's think about harm reduction for somebody who's cutting themselves or burning themselves, self-harm. What can replace that? Well, turns out we can get a very similar endorphin release by holding an ice cube in our hand, maybe a couple of ice cubes,
right,
in our hand.
Yeah.
For let's say 2 minutes. Now, we don't want to ever go longer than that because there is potential that we can actually get frostbite. We can do the same thing, by the way, by sticking our hand in a bucket of ice water. If you have a bucket of ice water and just stick your hand in it for, don't go longer than a minute. Because you know, that can also do actual tissue damage. If you go too long, but a minute, you get a massive endorphin release. And, you know, again, it's not the ultimate destination. We ultimately want to get a person to a place where, you know, A, they're not experiencing that kind of pain, and B, they have other even more adaptive ways of dealing with it. But as a harm reduction model, I'm a big fan of those kind of stop gaps. Some patients will like wear a little rubber band on their wrist and then snap it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And again, you know, I've seen some that get carried away and they like actually induce blisters that can break open and start bleeding. And, you know, it's like, no, we don't want to make this just like cutting, right? But if they can just snap it enough to get that little piquant little sensation of like, oh yeah, like this is enough for me. I don't need to actually go all the way to cutting. That can be a really useful sort of intermediate step.
So like, I know we're like off the cuff here, but what would the pathway kind of look like to that longer term plan? Like, is that like some form of therapy? Is it some sort of like woo-woo, like self-healing journey you need to go on? Like, you know, like what are some of like the next steps if someone's kind of like in that self-harm cycle? Like, where do they kind of, where's the off-ramp? Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. Well, I would say most commonly the people that I've known who engage in self-harm have one of three diagnoses, and maybe more than one, but either they are clinically depressed, in which case we have a whole armamentarium of things that we can use to help lift their depression. So to lift that extraordinary emotional pain of clinical depression. And then once their depressive episode is lifted, they don't feel the same impetus to self-harm anymore. Second possibility is they have post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and we have to do an episode, maybe a whole, you know, little mini series on PTSD. But there are some very effective psychotherapy protocols for post-traumatic stress disorder. They usually take 3 to 4 months with a very skilled psychotherapist. And again, you know, the person with PTSD is being haunted by and revisited by a former traumatic experience. And so the self-harm can be a reaction to that sort of re-experiencing. And as we heal the scarring, the emotional scarring, the after effects of trauma, then we can lift the impetus to self-harm. And then finally, there is a personality disorder called borderline personality disorder. And it's, and we may take the deep dive on that someday, but it's characterized. These are people that have extraordinarily intense emotional reactions. Their brains and their minds are just wired for extremely intense emotion. And so there is an entire extraordinary protocol for borderline personality called DBT. It stands for dialectical behavior therapy. And it teaches a whole array of emotion regulation skills that can be used basically whenever emotional pain is getting to the point where it's going to be a trigger for self-harm. It's like, oh, well, no, now I have some self-soothing skills that I can use instead. Now I have some distress tolerance skills. Oh, now I have some mindfulness skills that I can use instead. And so, you know, we have to be a little bit fine-grained and nuanced in exactly how, you know, we have to basically do a little detective work to figure out like, oh, all right, well, what is driving the self-harm behavior? What's the underlying source of suffering? And now once we figure that out, well, we have the tools, we can fix this, but we got to do that detective work first.
I love that, because like so often in life and so often on the show, like you kind of come to that realization that the thing that you thought was the task is actually just a symptom. Do you know what I mean?
And like, yeah, exactly.
So I feel like so much of even my life, like growing up, has been, oh, like this symptom is like, this is the big issue that I need to work on. And actually, you know, you're just dealing with a little tiny, like small twig instead of getting to like the tree trunk of the issue. Do you know what I mean? And once you kind of deal with like whatever that big issue is, whether it's some sort of mental health disorder or some, you know, like big trauma that you're working through, you know, if you focus all your effort on that, then in theory, everything else will kind of take care of itself, or at least become a lot easier to chop those things off, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I learned that lesson kind of the hard way, really, as a fledgling psychotherapist working with people with depression. And I was originally trained, as we've talked about a few times on the show, I was trained in the kind of the gold standard of psychotherapy for depression called CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. And the basic premise of CBT is like, okay, well, depressive emotions are driven by negative thoughts. So if you're going to do CBT for depression, then you want to help patients like start noticing their negative thoughts and writing them down and challenging them and learning how to treat them not as fact, but as hypothesis and gathering evidence and doing hypothesis testing, yada, yada. It's very complicated. It takes a long time to get good at. But when patients are willing to put in the effort after 6-8 weeks, like they start to get kind of good at it, and it can be helpful. But then I discovered it's like, hey, you know what? A lot of the negative thinking of depression is not driving it so much as it's a symptom. Mm. And if we can just lift their depression, then a lot of those negative thoughts are just going to evaporate. Like they are a function of this state of clinical depression in most cases. So anything we do to get the depression better will actually get those negative thoughts better. And so, talk about a, you know, mind-blowing epiphany. But when I finally broke the code on that, I was like, oh, okay. So there are more efficient ways usually that we can get at this.
Awesome. Well, finally spoken, gentlemen, thank you so much for listening. We hope that answered your question. Hope it gave you a few ideas. And we really appreciate you sending the question through.
Yeah. Sorry, Hugh. Thank you so much for that. It was a really wonderful question.
Awesome. Steve, thanks for your time. Looking forward to the next one.
Can't wait.
Awesome stuff. Thanks so much once again to today's question asker. Really appreciate you taking the time to do so. And like I said at the top of the show, if you'd like to submit your own question to Steve and I, you can do so via our Patreon community. patreon.com/mentalhealthpodcast is the link. That'll also be in the description of this episode, wherever you're listening. And that is the place where people just like you support this crowdfunded show. We don't have any sponsors. We don't have any brand guidelines we have to stick to or products we have to promote. And Steve and I think that that's really important for our own editorial integrity and also for the longevity of this podcast. It doesn't take a lot of people. It just takes a few of you listening who have the means and who want to get behind and support what we're doing. You believe in our mission to provide free, high quality educational content around the topic of mental health, and for that to be available for people around the world, no matter what their circumstances are or where they live. So yeah, if that's something that you've been considering for a while, we would really appreciate you heading over to Patreon to join us there. And other than that, thanks so much for spending this time with us, and I hope to catch you again next time. Cheers.